What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Beth Serdet, discussing the modern tallit, the prayer shawl. We'll also have a visit from our Too Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our Mevna on Israel, Oshrat Barel. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. We are now just 8 days from the beginning of Pesach, Passover, the great freedom festival of the spring, which is also the festival of Matzah. Actually, Pesach has four official names in Jewish tradition. Chag HaPesach, or Passover, of course, for the Paschal offering, the lamb that was sacrificed and roasted in the days of the Bible and the Temple. Chag HaMatzot, the holiday of Matzah, the unleavened bread we eat for the week of Passover. Chag HaAviv, the springtime festival, probably the oldest of the names of Passover. And most thematically, Zman Cheruteinu, the season of our freedom. Each of these names has something important to teach us, and each is interesting in and of itself. The word Pesach itself comes from the word for leaping or jumping in Hebrew, an apt description of the ways that young lambs leap and cavort in the fields. The use of this animal for the sacrifice of the Passover reminds us that the angel of death leaped over the homes of the Israelites, striking the firstborn of the Egyptians dead, and it also refreshes for us the memory of the leaping joy of freedom, the ability to move and act as we wish that's prevented during slavery. Free people can cavort, if you will, skip, dance, jump as they please. Slaves jump to somebody else's command, hence Chag HaPesach, the holiday of, well, skipping. The second name for Passover is Chag HaMatzot, the festival of the poor man's bread, matzah. Unleavened bread, made with just flour and water in 18 minutes or less, baked quickly and simply. The food that our ancestors made is preparation for a hasty journey and flight. Of course, on Pesach, we eat matzah all week and therefore do not eat chametz, which is best described as being the opposite of matzah, anything made with leavening or fermentation. That means lots of matzah. More about that later. The third name for this festival is Chag HaAviv, the holiday of springtime. Undoubtedly, there was a spring festival observed long before the events of the Exodus led to the creation of this holiday. Spring is celebrated in every culture and nearly every religion. In our Seder celebrations, the orderly meal we hold on the first two nights of Passover that teaches the meaning and story of freedom in a rich and wonderful variety of ways, spring is featured in the green vegetables we dip in salt water and in the hard-boiled eggs, symbolizing the rebirth of spring. The magnificent love poem, Shir HaShirim, the Song of Songs, is chanted on Passover, filled with images of gardens and growth and love and the flowering springtime. A wonderful way to celebrate this most beautiful and verdant of all seasons. And finally, the ultimate theme of Passover is freedom. Zman Cheruteinu, the time of our liberation. It is this essential ideal that's woven all through the week of Passover, the central focus on God's gift of liberty that has made Pesach the model freedom festival for the whole world. In every generation, each of us is obligated to see ourselves as though we personally had been brought out of Egypt. B'chol dor v'dor chayav adam lirot et atzmo ke'ilu hu yatzah mimitzrayim. In addition to our own celebration of our ancestors' freedom, we learn compassion, even empathy. For when we can view ourselves as survivors of slavery, we are compelled to sympathize with the dispossessed, a central principle of Jewish belief. And so, to play us in this morning, here's a bit of our pre-Passover preview of Pesach music from the Three Jewish Tenors, a tribute to the great old-time cantor Moshe Oysher, a mini-medley of tunes from the Passover Seder, Ki Lo Na'eh and Chag Gadyah, two Hasidic versions of these classic Passover Seder songs.
Ki
That was the three Jewish tenors, Abe Mizrahi, Meir Finkelstein, and David Propus, singing a mini medley of Moshe Oysher melodies for the Passover Seder. Boy, that would be some Seder if you had all three of those guys. Passover is a reminder of what it's like to be a slave. Now, besides watching that Oscar-winning film 12 Years a Slave, the best way to feel the pain of slavery today is to eat lechem oni, the poor man's bread, what we Jews call matzah. Now, while I love almost everything about being Jewish, my one area of personal aversion, the one Jewish food I find to be painful and nearly inedible, is the one food we must eat in profusion this time of year, that ever-popular rendition of baked perforated cardboard, matzah, the bread of true affliction. I guess that to me, when the Israelites were given the choice between personal and religious freedom and eating only unleavened bread or staying in slavery, it must have been a tough choice. I'm not sure I might not have chosen slavery. I know, I'll receive much criticism and emails and calls and texts professing shock that I can't stand matzah. How can I call myself a rabbi? And matzah with butter and salt is a fabulous food to eat. You know, frankly, anything with butter and salt tastes pretty good, including, but not limited to, newspaper and shirt cardboard, which matzah, of course, closely resembles. I mean, the French cook snails with butter and salt and claim they are edible, so we Jews can just do the same with matzah. But never let it be said that I can't be magnanimous on such subjects, and I must admit that my profound distaste for matzah is not shared by most Jews. Of course, we Jews are known for embracing suffering and having martyr complexes, so matzah might just be the perfect Jewish food. As Marilyn Monroe, perhaps the most famous convert to Judaism at one point, said after enjoying the Jewish delicacy of matzah balls, "Isn't there any other part of the matzah that we eat?" That quote is also ascribed to George W. Bush, by the way. Sadly, no, unless you count the box, which of course tastes the same as the matzah. Actually, in spite of my aversion to matzah, I am the owner of a matzah tie. Now, that tie is not actually made out of matzah. That would be very hard to launder. Plus, how could you tell if it got crumbs on it? But actually, what I have is a silk tie with a very lifelike matzah print on it. I wear this tie, well, religiously, the week of Pesach, and everybody admires it. And then I explained to him that it probably not only looks like matzah, but tastes like matzah, too. Here, take a bite of the tie. Yum. In any case, if you like matzah, I hope you enjoy yours starting a week from tomorrow night. You can have most of mine, too. Throughout history, the tallis has been an underappreciated garment, worn for morning services and all day on Yom Kippur, but not notable for its unique or beautiful qualities. But the last few decades have changed all of that. Today, the most beautiful tallitot are true works of art, textiles of personal expression. When we come back in a few moments, we'll meet a real tallis artist, Beth Surdit, and explore what that means right here on Too Jewish. Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics. academics, and they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org. We are delighted to welcome the two Jewish art guests this morning. Beth Serdet makes what she calls the modern tallit, and we're going to talk a little bit about not only the beautiful art that she does with a tallit, or tallis, the prayer shawl that Jews wear on morning services when we pray, but also how it came to be such an important and different kind of ritual object and form of artistic expression and personal expression. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Good morning. I'm so happy to be here, Rabbi.
Beth, tell me, the modern tallit, when does the tallit become modern? It's, after all, one of the oldest objects in Jewish life. What makes it modern?
Your first tallit is the modern tallit to you because it's the first one you've ever had. There are a lot of us who had a tallit from our father, passed down from grandfather, in various states of repair. But in this day and age, my feeling is that we live in a very busy world, and a way to walk out of the daily chatter is to wrap a tallit around us, a prayer shawl around us, that allows us to walk out of that chatter and into meditation.
The first tallit I got, like many people's, mine was black and white, and it was wool. And I got what was a big one when I was 12, but eventually I outgrew. Most of the ones that you saw the whole time I was growing up were either black and white or blue and white. The Israeli flag is modeled on the tallit. When does it begin to change?
When you were growing up, you probably didn't see many women wearing tallitot.
Not many.
Women actually were allowed to wear them for centuries, and then somewhere along the line, someone decided that perhaps a woman wearing a tallit was anything that's time-sensitive.
A time-bound mitzvah.
Time-bound mitzvah.
Right. Mitzvah shizman groma, it says in the Talmud, right?
Yes, is because women are so busy raising children, and of course this was a time where the women raised the children and the men were the breadwinners, hopefully, that this was something, this was one less thing that they had to do. But lives have changed. And in my perspective, everyone should have the opportunity to walk into prayer at any time that they want to.
So we will explore how women's influence helped shape the concept that a tallit could be a form of spiritual expression, personal expression, when we come back in a few minutes here on Two Jewish with our guest, Beth Serdet.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
We welcome David and Pam of Freedom Smoke. Tell us about your product, Freedom Smoke.
Hello, Rabbi Kohan. A pleasure to be here again. Electronic cigarette industry has been around for years. Our product, one of the best things that we've done to improve it is the base ingredients for our product are brought in from outside of this country. The only place in the world is certified kosher.
Kosher, smokeless, no tobacco, and a variety of health advantages. Do you have a lot of former smokers that have kind of quit because of Freedom Smoke?
Absolutely. We have several people who have written to us as well as told us on a personal basis.
How many flavors are there of what you sell?
Over 700.
And when people walk in the store and they don't know what to do, what do you tell them?
We start them off by finding out what they smoke and how much they smoke. We then set them up with the nicotine level that's appropriate for them, and we find the correct flavor, and that's all that it takes.
How do people find your stores?
They can find us on the internet, of course, freedomsmokeusa.com. We have a toll-free number, 800-705-7013. Word of mouth is really good for our company, bringing people into our stores.
And it's kosher.
That's correct. Yep.
We'll talk next week.
Thank you.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website or download us from the Apple iTunes Store's very popular podcasts. The Temple Emmanuel Pilgrimage Trip to Israel with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, is going June 11th to June 23rd, 2014. If you're interested in going with me on this fantastic journey to see all of Israel, from Tel Aviv to Haifa to Tzfat to the Sea of Galilee, up to Masada to Jerusalem, everywhere, including the beach, please email me at TOOJewishRadio18, TOOJewishRadio18@gmail.com, or call 520-327-4501 for more information and an itinerary. We continue now with our pre-Pesach preview of Passover music with a choir of young voices singing the Simon LeSeder Shel Pesach, the table of contents which we'll sing at Seder next week, Kadesh or Chatz. That was Kadesh Ur Chatz for Passover, about a week and a day from now. In preparation for Pesach, our Jewish Poetry Slam this morning is on the theme of Exodus, of leaving, going outward to a new reality, abandoning all we have known. It's from Marge Piercy's wonderful poem Magid. The courage to let go of the door, the handle. The courage to shed the familiar walls whose very stains and leaks are comfortable as the little moles of the upper arm, stains that recall a feast, a child's naughtiness, a loud blattering storm that slapped the roof hard pouring through. The courage to abandon graves dug into the hill, the small bones of children and the brittle bones of the old whose marrow hunger had stolen. The courage to desert the tree planted and only begun to bear, the riverside where promises were shaped, the street where their empty pots were broken. The courage to leave the place whose language you learned as early as your own, whose customs, however dangerous or demeaning, bind you like a halter you have learned to pull inside to move your load. The land fertile with the blood spilled on it, the roads mapped and annotated for survival. The courage to walk out of the pain that is known into the pain that cannot be imagined, mapless, going barefoot without a canteen into the desert. We honor those who let go of everything but freedom, who ran, who revolted, who fought, who became other, by saving themselves. That was the poem Magid by Marge Piercy in preparation for Pesach. The first Seder is just a week from tomorrow night, Monday, April 14th. And now it's time for a recurring, inscrutably irregular feature of Two Jewish, Haikus for Jews, the wisdom of Zen Judaism. This one, a Passover haiku. Lacking fins or tail, the gefilte fish swims with great difficulty. That was Eternal Wisdom from Zen Judaism, Haikus for Jews from the coming festival of Passover. We welcome our Mevinan, Israel Oshrat Barel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center here in Tucson. Boker Tov, Oshrat.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
We've been talking a little bit about Israeli identity. Last week, at the very end of our discussion, we talked about whether there's such an identity as an Israeli identity without it being a Jewish identity, and that's become a kind of an idea in Israel. Let's discuss that a little bit.
Yeah, I think it started almost 100 years ago when young, ambitious, socialist and Zionist came from Eastern Europe to build the new Jew, right?
The new Jew,
the
right?
The new Jew, not the pale
tough
one.
Jew,
not the pale one with the book, you know.
Not the scholar,
one
but the fighter,
sun,
the farmer, the worker, the pioneer.
Yeah, good-looking guy outside of the sun, working at the field.
In his sandals.
In his sandals, yeah, or without.
Or without,
anyway,
right?
So I think it starts then, and the kibbutzim movement really encouraged this, a new Jew. And the kibbutzim really celebrated all the holidays, the high holidays. Do you know what the high holidays in the kibbutzim?
Well, Shavuot, one
yeah,
of them, and
Shavuot,
Sukkot, the
and
harvest festival, and Purim.
Shavuot and Purim, yeah. And Yom Kippur, you know what's the name of Yom Kippur?
No.
It was the mangal day. It was the barbecue day.
Oh, the barbecue
anyway,
day.
Anyway.
They were really socialists.
Yeah, they really, yeah. They
and
were,
really secular.
They liked the Bible, but they took the main actor out of it.
Right.
They took God out
they
of it.
They took God out.
Anyway, so I think right now, 100 years later, we are really facing the outcomes of, you know, creating the new Jew. Because there is people in Israel that they think that being Israeli, like, it's enough. There is something that called Israeli identity. But if I will ask you and I will ask our audience or I will ask people, what does it mean to be Israeli? What is Israeli identity? Yeah, it's really hard to define. I don't know if there is a way to define it in a way that will be like meaningful, and people say, "Yeah, I'm an Israeli," and it's something that it's worth to live in Israel for. I hope you understand me because, like,
so.
There is kids like that going to army or finishing their service
the
and
military
asking
service,
themselves.
Right.
Wow,
why
God,
do I
want to
live in such
why
an uptight
did I
country?
Give 3 of my beautiful years and to serve the army and to see all these horrible, you know, sights and, you know, what for? For being Israeli? What does it mean to be Israeli? If you take out the Jewish component of it, of our Israeli identity, it's
right.
really hard to answer this question. And I can tell you from my personal experience and friends and family, it's really hard to answer it in a way to say, yeah, it's worthwhile to live here in Israel for whatever it is, Israeli identity. But if I'm really remember and appreciate God to be such a great real estate agent and give us Israel, give it to Abraham, and I believe it in all my heart.
Right.
So that makes sense, like to fight for the country.
For the land
and,
that's
yeah,
your people's
yeah,
land.
And without it, I really can't answer why do I will go back after 3 years in beautiful Tucson to Israel.
Yeah, or fascinatingly, lots of Israelis moving to Germany, of all places. Of all places, because it's a calm place,
calm
it's organized,
place.
It's clean.
And it's cheap.
And it's cheap.
Oh
wow.
My God. Yeah.
Amazing to think about. We will talk next week. Thanks,
yeah,
Oshan.
Yeah, thank you.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week. You can help send kids to our community's Jewish schools without it costing you a dime. Direct your state tax dollars instead to JETCO, the Jewish Education Tax Credit Organization. The state allows its taxpayers to receive a dollar-for-dollar tax credit, not just a deduction, for payments made to recognized school tuition organizations, who then provide scholarships for kids in kindergarten through 12th grade who go to qualified private schools. JETCO provides quality Jewish education to children in need at Temple Emmanuel Kindergarten, Congregation Anshe Israel Kindergarten, Tucson JCC Kindergarten, and the Tucson Hebrew Academy. If you pay Arizona state income taxes, make your contribution to JETCO, you'll receive 100% tax credit on your state income tax return. Tax credit, not a deduction. There's an additional tax credit, the switcher credit this year. You can go up to $1,031 to JETCO for a single filer, $2,062 for married couples filing jointly. When we need every dollar we can for Jewish education, this is the time to make a contribution to JETCO. Do so by calling 647-8442, that's 647-8442, or visit JETCO on the web, jetco.org. Give the gift of education. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been discussing the Ukraine and the Russia and all of the dramatic events taking place there, but also the countries in the background. A lot of the focus of this conflict has been in the Crimea. Let's talk about, first of all, what the Crimea is, why it's so important to Russia, why it's important to Ukraine, and a little bit about its history and background.
Okay, so the Crimea is a peninsula that sticks out into the Black Sea, which through an accident of geography has always been part of Ukraine. Lots of ancient Greeks settled there, the Greeks who settled all along the coast of the Black Sea and were called Pontic Greeks. Then there were Cossacks who lived there. It was part of the Ottoman Empire for many years.
I think actually the Khazars were even there at one point, the Jewish Empire in the Middle Ages.
Yeah. I mean, historically, that doesn't leave much of an impact on Crimea, but it's an interesting footnote. But the Crimean War, for example, with the charge of the Light Brigade and into the Valley of Death rode the 600.
Tennyson's immortal lines.
Right. Was fought by Britain and France intervening to try to preserve the territorial integrity of the Ottoman Empire from Russian advances. Russia always wanted Crimea because it always sought as an eternal foreign policy objective warm water ports.
Right.
And Crimea is full of great ports, which have since become the major bases of the Russian Navy, or what was the Soviet Navy for a while. Now, imagine the awkward situation which resulted when Ukraine became independent upon the breakup of the Soviet Union. And this area that was so important to the Russian military establishment and that was largely populated by ethnic Russians, Russian speakers, people who were Russian religiously, ethnically, and every other way, this peninsula suddenly found itself part of Ukraine. So the Russians there voiced some slight worries, much slighter and much less well-founded than the worries of Russians in the Baltic countries, that they might be mistreated or that the Ukrainians might try to seek revenge for centuries of suppression and whatever. That hasn't happened, basically. The Russians and the Ukrainians are too similar, and the Russian military presence in Crimea made that extremely unlikely. But Putin, who probably sees himself as a czar more than a democratically elected leader.
Sure seems like it.
Right, he certainly acts that way. Doesn't want to go down in history as the czar who lost the Crimea. And it's not really about protecting the human rights of the Russian, not minority, but majority population there. And there's no question that the Ukrainians would not, they actually signed a base agreement, which specifies the terms by which the Soviet Navy can, the Russian Navy now, can kind of stay there forever. But there's no question of the Ukrainians being the aggressors in Crimea, no matter who's governing in Kyiv. And Crimea has an independent, an autonomous government anyway. But Putin just doesn't want to go down in history as the guy who lost the Crimea, even though that's highly unlikely to happen. And as we read recently in the newspaper, the German Chancellor Angela Merkel had a conversation with Putin and concluded that he's lost touch with reality in terms of his explanation for his behavior in Crimea. So if war breaks out or the situation degenerates, it's going to be over really the historic sense that Crimea is an integral part of Russia, which happens to be cut off and located in Ukrainian territory.
You know, it's fascinating that here we have a 21st century ruler of Russia who sees himself kind of as the new Peter the Great. Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie New, brought to you by Too Jewish as a Public Service. Max was crossing the street one day when he was hit by a bus. He was rushed to the hospital and put in intensive care. A few days later, Harry, his best friend, visits him. "So, how are things, Max?" Harry asks. "Not good," says Max. "My wife, Leah, visits me 3 times a day." "Well, what's bad about that?" says Harry. "Well," replies Max, "every time she comes, she sits at my bedside and reads to me." "Well, what's bad about that?" asks Harry. "What does she read?" And Max answers, "My life insurance policy." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the portion of Achrei Mot near the midpoint of the book of Leviticus, Vayikra. Leviticus is centered on the question of how we are to create holiness in our lives, and Achrei Mot addresses this issue in a variety of ways. It begins with words that are poignant without being revealing. After the death of Aaron's two sons, it says, referring to Nadav and Avihu, the young priests who died in the Torah portion of Shmini, for offering strange and inappropriate fire to the Lord. Aaron was enjoined to be cautious and scrupulous in all of his observances, lest he incur a similar punishment to that of Nadav and Avihu, his sons. Our portion then moves to the rituals related to the great and powerful Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur, holiest day of the whole year for our ancestors as it is for us. We are commanded to afflict our souls on that day, Ta'anu et nafshotechem. The rites described in Achrei Mot are very detailed. They form the basis for the ways in which our ancestors commemorated the Day of Atonement throughout the period when the temple stood in Jerusalem. The high priest purified himself completely, then offered sacrifices of atonement for himself, his family, and his people. He would then purify the holiest parts of the shrine and bring forward a goat as an atonement offering. That goat is one of the peculiarities of this ritual sequence. Actually, two goats are brought out. One, the scapegoat. This portion is the origin of that concept and that term. The scapegoat is given the burden of symbolically carrying the sins of the people out into the wilderness. The second goat is sacrificed as an atonement offering on the altar. Ultimately, after a day of self-denial and repentance, Ki vayom hazeyecha peralechem letaherethem b'chol chatotechem. On that day, atonement shall be made for you to purify you from all your sins. Through this process, we are restored to holiness. Much of the rest of Achrei Mot reflects the ways in which we fail to remain holy, however, and establishes rules to try to keep us on the straight and narrow. We are not supposed to practice idolatry, nor engage in blood sports, nor eat carrion, and so on. Each prohibition is another way of structuring holiness into our lives, of keeping us from engaging in unholy behaviors. Finally, Achrei Mot is interested in the question of establishing the prohibited degrees of marriage, the people with whom we are not supposed to enter into matrimony, the laws of consanguinity and moral respect for those who are most closely related to us. In essence, the emphasis throughout Achrei Mot is on the ways in which we reestablish a close relationship with God, and so reacquire holiness. In a world today in which our focus is far from holiness, shaped by the daily details of our lives and the clacks and call of commercial society, this emphasis on the sacred is striking. In the words of the psalm, "Keep yourself from evil. Strive to do what is good and right. Seek holiness every day." Outstanding principles to live by right now. Speaking of outstanding principles, there are also outstanding garments. The prayer shawl, the tallit, is one of the distinctive elements in all of Jewish ritual life. Symbolic of the commandments, a tangible reminder of God's role in our lives, the tallis was always a simple blue and white or black and white cloth with fringes. But today the modern tallit has become an object of artistic beauty and personal expression. We'll explore how this happened, how it changed, and what it means to have a truly beautiful contemporary tallis with artist Beth Sertit when we return on Too Jewish.
Environmental Strategies Incorporated was established in Arizona almost 15 years ago. They're a corporation that's very unique and has distinguished itself as one of the foremost environmental remediation companies in Arizona. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is also a full-service general contractor. The fact that they have two divisions affords their clients the opportunity to work with one contractor to deal with environmental problems as well as their building and remodeling needs. Environmental Strategies clientele range from single-family homeowners to multi-million-dollar Fortune 500 companies. So, if you're in need of asbestos abatement, mold remediation, or general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies at 884-1114. And, if you wish, ask for Ken Goodman, the president. He'd be more than happy to talk with you about your project. That's Environmental Strategies, 884-1114. We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
An Israeli judge last week convicted former Prime Minister Ehud Olmert for taking bribes while he was the mayor of Jerusalem. Completing nearly 2 years of trial, the Tel Aviv District Court judge David Rosen convicted Olmert, as well as former Jerusalem mayor Uri Lapolyansky, former Bank Hapoalim chairman Dan Dankner, and Olmert's former chief of staff Shula Zakein. In total, actually 10 out of 13 individual defendants were convicted. Ehud Olmert was convicted of receiving about $160,000 in bribes related to a controversial Jerusalem housing project called Holy Land. The judge did acquit Olmert on a third count of bribery. The developer of Holy Land, Hillel Cherney, had been previously convicted for bribing Olmert and other high-level officials in exchange for land approvals. Olmert was mayor of Jerusalem from 1993 to 2003. His sentencing is scheduled for April 28th. Olmert, an attorney who in 1973 became the youngest person ever elected to the Knesset in Israel, served as prime minister from 2006 to 2009. He announced his resignation shortly after police recommended corruption charges against him. It's been a long process. In August of 2012, Olmert was convicted of breach of trust and acquitted on two corruption-related charges after a trial that had lasted for nearly 3 years. Then he was given a 3-month suspended jail sentence and fined about $20,000. Those earlier allegations stem from Olmert's time as mayor as well as prime minister. Prosecutors accused him of double billing government agencies for travel, taking cash from an American businessman in exchange for official favors, and acting on behalf of his former law partner's clients. With his conviction, Ehud Olmert's political career may finally be done, and he will likely face jail time. An ugly professional end for an Israeli prime minister. In other Jewish news, President Obama awarded 24 Jewish, Hispanic, and African American veterans the medals of honor they'd earned but never received. Many on the list are already dead, including a Jewish guy from Brooklyn named Lenny Kravitz, uncle of a certain musician and movie star in Hunger Games whom you may have heard of, also called Lenny Kravitz. "These families join us here today," Obama said, "and they know more than most that because others laid down their lives for us, we've been able to live our lives in freedom, to pursue our dreams. There's a legacy here born of sacrifice," the president said. "That includes a soldier's nephew, a kid from New York, who grew up to become one of the great rock stars of all time and who honors his uncle here today." In the Medal of Honor presentation, it noted that Private First Class Leonard Kravitz distinguished himself by acts of gallantry and intrepidity above and beyond the call of duty when he served as assistant machine gunner during combat against an armed North Korean enemy in Yongpyong, Korea, March 6th and 7th, 1951. After friendly elements had repulsed two probing attacks, the enemy launched a fanatical bonsai charge with heavy supporting fire. Despite staggering losses, pressed the assault with ruthless determination. When the machine gunner was wounded in the initial phase of the action, Private First Class Kravitz immediately seized the weapon, pouring devastating fire into the ranks of the onrushing assailants. Upon being ordered to withdraw, Private First Class Kravitz voluntarily remained to provide protective fire for the retiring elements. His shooting caused the enemy to concentrate on his position and enabled the friendly elements to withdraw. Later, Private First Class Kravitz was found dead behind the gun he had so heroically manned, surrounded by numerous enemy dead. Kravitz's extraordinary heroism and selflessness at the cost of his own life, above and beyond the call of duty, are in keeping with the highest traditions of military service and reflect great credit upon himself, his unit, and the U.S. Army. And now, rock star Lenny Kravitz's uncle, Lenny Kravitz, has received his long-delayed Medal of Honor.
What did he say?
He's going to destroy the world.
My father said that one day, if man continued in his ways, the Creator would annihilate this world.
Can it not be averted?
He speaks to you. You must trust that he speaks in a way that you can understand.
I saw water, death by water. And I saw new life.
great flood is coming. We build a vessel to survive the storm. We build an ark.
There's a new movie out about Noah, starring Russell Crowe. It's at the top of the box office list, making it the most successful film in America, at least last week. This Noah film, a long and hyper-dramatic version of the classic flood story in the Torah, has provoked some controversy, though much less than that which swirls around every new movie about Jesus. Anyway, the movie itself comes with an official disclaimer. It says at the start, "This film is inspired by the story of Noah. While artistic license has been taken, we believe that this film is true to the essence, values, and integrity of a story that is the cornerstone of faith for millions of people worldwide." Well, I'm not sure about that, actually, as this was originally our story. You know, it's in the Torah, and we never really considered the Noah tale central to Jewish belief. I think that for most Jews, including many Orthodox ones, we view the Noah tale as a kind of prehistory of the Torah, reflecting the Bible's focus on Brit, on a covenantal relationship with God that preceded the call of Abraham. I suppose that for those who prefer their Torah tales accurate to the original text, this version, this Noah movie, won't satisfy them. But for those of us who traffic in Midrash, it's an interesting interpretation, a reinterpretation of a powerful and meaningful text and tradition. It's also fascinating how much Russell Crowe now looks like Tevye in Fiddler on the Roof in this movie. Anyway, I think the Noah film is worth seeing, although perhaps not at first-run movie prices these days. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Around the World. We welcome back to Two Jewish, our guest this morning, Beth Sirdit. She's here talking about the modern Talit. Beth is an artist and does really beautiful silk work in Talitot, the prayer shawls that we Jews use for prayer and morning services, and of course on Kol Nidrei Eve. And some of us rabbis and cantors get to wear them at other times too to help lead services even in the evening. Beth, tell us what motivated you to begin creating the Talitot, the taluses that you make.
I think perhaps the underlying motive I didn't even know about until after I started doing them. I found out that when my grandfather came over from Russia, he left two brothers who had been studying to be Torah scribes.
Sofrim, to be a sofer, right?
And they were murdered by the Cossacks. And I hadn't thought about that until I started doing the prayer shawls. And I did that because one year I was looking at the 613 mitzvot in the story that the pomegranate has 613 seeds to match that. Not that I actually counted. So I made a scarf for myself with these designs, and I held it up and I looked at it and I said, this could become a prayer shawl. I made a prayer shawl for myself, which is the sunset, the hot reds and pink sunset over the mountains.
By the way, I have to say, it's gorgeous.
Thank you. And the prayer that I chose for myself, because a talit has to have four corners, it has to have tzitzit, and it has to have an atara, but beyond that, other than perhaps not mixing materials
wool
together,
and flax, right?
It can be whatever a person wants it to be.
And I should clarify for our listeners that tzitzit are the large fringe that you see at the corners of the talit, not just any fringes, but kind of large knotted fringes.
And the knots and the wraps and the gematria in the way that I do it spell out God is one.
Right. And some people say there's 613 knots and fringes too in a talit. And then the atara, the other thing you talked about, of course, is the kind of the crown. It's the strip that goes across what will eventually go over your shoulders when you're putting on the talit. Sometimes that has a blessing, sometimes it's decorative in other ways, but it's always an additional strip.
Yes, and traditionally, it's the directive to wear tzitzit.
Right.
My idea when I started creating the prayer shawls was the more personally attached I felt to my walking portal into prayer, the more comfortable I would feel with it. And as you know, traditionally, when you pick up your prayer shawl, you kiss each end of the prayer as you would a good friend on the cheeks. So the idea that I would read this prayer, kiss my good friend, and walk into it was really appealing to me. Mm-hmm. So the prayer that I chose is, "May the words of my mouth and the meditations of my heart be acceptable in thy sight, Adonai, my rock and my redeemer.
Right. So that's from, it's a lovely meditative piece in near the very end of the Amidah, kind of as a coda to the central prayer. It's a beautiful section. Did you put that into the, you worked that into the Atara or into
yes.
the body?
Yes, I draw out, everything's done by hand. I draw out all of the letters and I paint the fabric with a fiber reactive dye, which gives it a lush color and feel. But when I went to my rabbi, Rabbi Malka Drucker at Hamakom in Santa Fe, Rabbi Drucker saw my pomegranates and she said, that's what I want. She ended up choosing the same prayer, which was really lovely. And from there, people started finding me from all over the United States. People who didn't know me, they just went on the web and they found me. And each story contained in the prayer shawl is very, very personal. Very personal. And there's one prayer shawl that I did for a woman from the Republic of Georgia whose parents were murdered by the Russian mafia. She's a Jew by choice. She found out that her grandfather was Jewish. And she told me a dream that she had. And I painted the dream onto her prayer shawl.
Wow. Yours are silk.
Yes.
I know, the only thing I know about silk is it's expensive, light, and beautiful. There's different kinds of silk. How did you decide which kind of silk to make your talitot out of?
When one puts on a prayer shawl, it should have a little weight to it. But we live in hot climates. And my little joke is that God said tzitzit, he didn't say shvitzit. So I tend to make one that is obviously a prayer shawl. I use a sand-washed crepe de chine silk, which is called the Mercedes of silk. Soft to the touch, doesn't really wrinkle. And then for the atara and for the corners, which are kanaf, wings, I use a silk charmeuse, which is what you see in the gorgeous Jane Harlow slinky gowns. It has a little sheen to it. And so by the time I put that on, sew those on, and wrap the tzitzit, you put it on and you don't have to play with it. It's not going to go anywhere. So that's how I came to that. You should feel that you're wearing something around your shoulders, not a little scarf.
One of the really interesting things about the varieties of different talitot that are available now are that some, as you said, look like they're little scarves. They're sort of cute little decorative things. The prayer shawl, one of the real central commandments in Judaism, we see people wearing yarmulkes and the kippah, but there's no commandment to wear a kippah. The Torah has the commandment for the tzitzit, which makes it one of the really ancient commandments we're supposed to follow, one of the ancient mitzvot. Is there a special process in creating these? Do you have to say blessings, or is it just like creating any garment?
I don't believe it's like creating any garment, because I know when I start what it's going to be. For me, actually, the prayer has to come first. People will tell me their favorite colors and their interests and things that they may want on the prayer shawl. But until we choose the prayer, nothing else is going to happen. So it is very specific to its purpose. And from what I've seen, although certainly you can commission talitot, I've never seen any in the way that I do them or very specifically picking a personal prayer. And sometimes my clients range from 12 to 80s. And if they're in their 90s, that would be great too. And so depending on what's happened in somebody's life, the prayers can be very different. Or I've had a 12-year-old pick from the same psalm and essentially the same feeling as somebody in their mid-60s. But there's one prayer shawl in there. I call it the Marine Talit. It has orcas and dolphins. And I put an angelfish on the back because I thought everyone should have an angel at their back. But it's for a girl who knows that she wants to be a marine biologist. And she was very specific in having those orcas and dolphins together, which is really interesting because orcas eat dolphins.
Yes. Well, she's not a marine biologist yet.
No, she knew that. It was the idea that they could happily coexist on either side and face each other.
Kind of the peaceable kingdom of Tullus's.
Yeah, or Israel and Palestine.
No fooling. Has anybody commissioned more than one tallit from you? Because they're so unique and such an expression.
Not one, not two for themselves, but I have had people commission them for themselves and then for friends and for relatives. So yes, there's been multiples, but when somebody buys a tallit from me, no matter what their age, they look at it as something that will last a lifetime.
And you know, many people have the same tallis for their whole life, mm-hmm. and then often pass it on to their children or grandchildren, as you said. And it'll be interesting to see when tallitot now that are such personal expressions, how those carry from generation to generation. It'll be an interesting
and they may not
new thing.
They may not. When my father, may his memory be a blessing, passed 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to call it a tallis because that's what we grow up calling
it. I'm sure that's what he called it.
When I found his tallis, because he was gone, I didn't know the history of it, but it was very small and very, very worn. But the case that I used to carry mine in was a velvet case that says tallit in Hebrew on it and was pretty fresh. And so I don't wear his tallis, but I carry that case, and I know every time I take my prayer shawl out of it that my father's with me in some way.
In addition to the tallitot, and I know that's the focus of our discussion, you've also made these healing scarves. Can you explain a little bit about how that evolved?
One of my tallit clients came to me, and she said that she had a friend who had lost her hair to chemotherapy, and the high holidays were coming up, and could I make her a headscarf with, as she said, some sort of prayer on it? And I thought,
something Jewish.
Something Jewish. And I said, well, of course, it's got to be Refuah Shlema. The idea that we can, if we can't physically heal somebody, that we can say to them, we are wishing you complete healing of body and spirit while you are suffering. Sometimes that's all we can do. And so when somebody asks for one of those, of course, I drop everything I'm doing, because it needs to be done right away. But it's a double-edged sword because I get the joy of making something beautiful for somebody who's ill, but I know that somebody is ill. And then I have this whole flock of cancer survivors that I kind of keep track of to see how they're doing.
You made one for Gabby Giffords too, didn't you? Past guest of Too Jewish many times, a good friend of many listeners here.
I don't know Miss Giffords, but I woke up one morning in Santa Fe. I had never made a scarf for somebody just out of the blue. But I had this feeling I was supposed to make one. I went online, I was reading the news, I saw what happened, and I said, well, that's who I'm supposed to be making it for. So I made it and I gave it to my congregation and said, you know, don't give it in my name, give it in the congregation's name.
It's very thoughtful and a lovely way to connect to healing and to, as you said, the Refuah Shlema, the divine spirit. What's your favorite tallit you've ever made?
That's a really hard question because they all have, in some ways, they're all favorites. And I don't mean that. I know it's like asking who's your favorite child and you're not supposed to say. But one of my favorites.
You know, I have three teenagers. Right now, none.
Well, after you lock them in a closet for 5 years, they'll be fine.
They all have good days. Or maybe it's me. Maybe I have good days. Anyway.
Perhaps my favorite. I do a lot of music-themed tallit. And I got a call from a woman in the Hudson Bay area of New York State. And she wanted not one, but two tallitot. One for her daughter's bat mitzvah and one for the religious school teacher / cantor who was coaching her.
What a lovely gift. People want to find out more about the modern tallit and about the work that you do. What's the website?
www.bethsurdut.com. You just run my name together, BethSurdut.com.
Thank you for a great visit and a great exploration of the tallit, the prayer shawl, and its meaning, and some of your beautiful work. Thanks very much, Beth.
Thanks for having me here.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest and get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 o'clock. Our guest will be the legendary actor Ed Asner, winner of more Emmy Awards than any other male actor. He'll be speaking about the Freedom Seder coming soon to Temple Emmanuel. Our playout this morning comes from one of our more eclectic CDs of Pesach music, with Passover coming up in just over a week, beginning on April 14th at sundown. This one's from the Reggae Passover recording. It's their version of the old spiritual, Go Down Moses. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week we pray of peace.
When Israel was in Egypt land,